As we mentioned in our first episode, Emmanuel Dastier once famously insisted that, at the start of things in 1940, you had to be maladjusted to be a resistant. So what do we think? Do we trust the judgment of a man whose nickname was the Anarchist in Dancing Shoes? To understand his quote, the best I can do is talk to you about perhaps the biggest name to play a role in the formation of the resistance. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to present the Spanish Civil War. The Spanish Civil War is a perfect subject for this episode, because depending on how you look at it, either World War II in Europe was a continuation of the Spanish Civil War, or the Spanish Civil War was preparation for World War II in Europe. But before we get into all that, let's rule out the most obvious connotation of Monsieur Dastier's quote, that there was something in the act of resistance itself that was off-kilter. As we also touched on in the first episode, to say politics was a blood sport in 1930s Europe is not hyperbole. According to Warren Carroll, in The Last Crusade, Spain, 1936, in Spain alone, 330 people were assassinated, 1,511 were wounded in political violence, there were 213 failed assassination attempts, and 113 general strikes. And that's before the Civil War started. In 1930s Europe, stats like that don't reflect a state of war, but a state of being. True, true, those stats are about Spain. But a lot of 1940s Europe got its start in Spain in the 1930s. Dastier's comment was about France, and France's climate wasn't far afield from that of its neighbor. For example, in the February 6th riots of 1934 in Paris, 16 people were killed, 2,000 injured, and a government toppled, that of Prime Minister Edouard Daladier. Then there were the counter-demonstrations 3 days later during the exchange of power, and 9 more people died. I don't mention these stats lightly or for shock value. I do this so you'll understand that the idea of people being politically active, even politically violent, wasn't an invention of World War II. So it's unlikely that the political activity of the resistance is what Monsieur Dastier was referring to. However, if those actions were normal, or normal in that context, then what made resisting abnormal? Let's take a look at another context of the resistance in 1940. Grab your passports and prepare to paint the town red. It'll be this context that takes us to Spain. The Spanish Civil War was a nearly 3-year conflict between fascism and communism / republicanism, aka democracy. And it was an early example of democratic republicans and communists making strange but productive bedfellows when confronted by a fascist threat. Though the Spanish republicans eventually lost, we can only guesstimate how much this alliance laid the groundwork for future collaborations against the Nazis. Later, the acceptance of communists into various groups of the resistance would prove one of its most volatile questions. When viewed through the rearview mirror, the question seems simple. But at the time, communists weren't just seen as potential insurgents or fifth columns. They were pariahs. Remember when I mentioned the popular expression, better Hitler than Blum? We need to keep in mind a lot of people in 1940 were true fascists. Goose-stepping, Hitler-adoring, today Europe, tomorrow the world, fascist. The kind that most of us today, thank a vet, only think we can imagine. Tragically for France, they and their allies had a lot of power at the time, and according to the inestimable Robert Paxton in his book Vichy France, they believed that the electoral victories of the Popular Front had been the start of a Bolshevik takeover. Let me repeat that. A Bolshevik takeover. As crazy as that sounds, remember they were living in an age when it wasn't crazy at all, but a very real possibility. And if you've ever been guilty of painting all those who disagree with you with the same brush, then you might understand why, after the victories of the Popular Front, their brushes were dripping red. The communists were certainly a part of that victory. What they weren't is hiding behind every bush and puppet-mastering the government. Despite this fact, the far-right's response to their electoral victory and other perceived communist threats was swift, stark, and totally illegal. After the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was ignited and tossed into international affairs, they declared the Communist Party in France illegal. As Paxton himself pointed out, the right switched from accusing the communists of dragging them into a war against Hitler to accusing them of not supporting the war against Hitler. An operatic change in key that would have surprised anyone expecting integrity from, well, from the sort of people who'd make a party illegal in the first place. What followed for the Communist Party, a party that had won its seats in free and fair elections, could politely be termed a nasty business. 74 members of the Chamber of Deputies were unseated, and their party newspaper, L'Humanité, was suppressed. On a local level, in a town near Lyon, over 40 people were arrested and held without charge, including the assistant mayor. William Scheer, in The Fall of the Third Republic, affirmed that the communists were treated as outlaws. Now, before you go feeling too bad for them, bear in mind this could have been seen as a soothing balm to the idealists of the party, those who were still shocked by Stalin's about-face. Weren't these the same fascists we'd all fought a civil war against in Spain? Some must have wondered. So while undoubtedly undemocratic, and thoroughly craven in nature, as the official response was, if you were in the party, it might have felt like an opportunity to slip under the radar and sort some things out for yourself. But what about the view from the bleachers? This is important to us because I suspect it gets to the heart of Dostoevsky's quote. To those outside the Communist Party, those who didn't have to spend this time unknotting complicated personal reactions to all the recent developments, this is what it looked like. Communists had become lepers. Disenfranchised, watched, if not arrested by the police, they were expatriates in their own country. How could this ever look appealing? It was bad enough for the people it was forced on, but what sort of maladjusted fool would you need to be to volunteer for this sort of treatment? Because that's what becoming a resistant must have looked like in 1940. Pétain had just saved France, at least as far as most Frenchmen were concerned. Government was new, fresh, trusted, and had absolutely no conscience when it came to cracking down on those that opposed them. For while Pétain was newly in charge in 1940, no one held any illusions that the current attitude towards communists was going to change. And even if it did, even if someone bothered to do the math on allies of Hitler theoretically being allies of the new national revolution, the way the communists had recently been treated still served as a warning for all potential dissidents. This is how we deal with the instigator, and the suspected instigator, it said. Despite this in-your-face example of what treatment they might expect to receive from their own countrymen, and this isn't even going into how the Germans could respond, despite all of this, somehow the idea of sharing in the hardships the communists were facing, just for the chance to fight back, didn't scare off as many people as you might have thought. I submit this was because it wasn't that truly scary of all scary concepts, a new idea. It was an idea that had been tested with some success in Spain only a few years before. I say with some success, not because Spain didn't fall to the fascists. Yes, Spain did fall. But it also served as a proving ground for a critical question. Can we do this? This meaning work together, and we being diehard communists and somebody, anybody else. The answer was yes. And with it, a team could be reborn and a resistance formed. Whether one joined with actual communists or not, the resistance of that time had had since 1939 a front row seat to the sort of treatment they'd be in for, and they knew who they'd be facing it with. It's an age-old question. Is the enemy of my enemy my enemy? The answer is, as long as their guns are pointed the right way, the other questions can be dealt with later. Or as the saying nearly goes, we'll blow up that bridge when we get to it. So despite knowing full well what they might be letting themselves in for, on July 10, 1940, 80 parliamentarians of the Chamber of Deputies voted against the dissolution of the Third Republic. They're ironically known by the name Vichy 80. Some went on to work in the resistance. One, Vincent Ariel, was placed under house arrest for his vote, and later, after working in the resistance during the war, became president of the Republic not once, but twice. As an interim president in late 46, and then again from 47 to 54. Another man, Vincent Badet, from Béziers, was removed from his position as mayor of Palaine, arrested, and sent to Dachau. They say living well is the best revenge, but after a war, living long often proves equally advantageous. Monsieur Badier returned from the camp and the National Assembly, representing the people of the Herald until 1958. And if you think resisting Vichy was a young man's game, remember Pierre de Chambrun, the only senator to join the 80, which wasn't too far off for him, as he was 75 at the time. He later joined the resistance too, and afterwards received the Croix de Guerre and was made a Chevalier of the Légion d'Honneur. These are just a few of the men known as the 80. Another 27 might have joined them, but they'd already set sail on a ship called the Massilla and were bound for Algiers, in an attempt to set up a government in exile. Vichy declared them traitors. Now we've spent some time going into why it was the timing of the actions, and the willingness to face what the communists were facing, and not the actions themselves, that might have prompted Dastier to call the resistance of the first hour maladjusted. What we haven't gone into is why such a maladjustment might have looked appealing in the first place. Toward that end, I offer the story of Edwige de Saint-Maxile. Apologies on the name pronunciation. She was a student in 1940, and took part in the famous student uprising on Armistice Day of that year. This was a time in which, thanks to a German protocol of correctness in behavior that was meant to forestall any insurgency, there was a degree of peace in the occupied territory. After all, they'd planned to be there for 1,000 years. Best not to get off on the wrong foot. At any rate, her class had been told there was to be no observation of Armistice Day, but she and about 1,000 others went to the tomb of the unknown soldier in Paris that day anyway to pay their respects. Nearby, Germans observed their actions. Correctness abandoned, shots were fired. The crowd scattered. The next day, all students were informed they had to report to the police in their quartier and answer questions, or there would be actions taken against their families. While there, in addition to being asked to register their religion with the state, something downright Twilight Zone-esque for France, they were asked to give their whereabouts at the time of the demonstration. Thinking quickly, Mademoiselle de Saint-Waxil said she'd been in a library that she knew didn't keep a sign-in sheet. However, the librarian said that they hadn't had any visitors at the time of the demonstration. For this, Miss de Saint-Waxil was brought in for questioning again. In the time between these two visits, they'd searched her apartment and found English-language tracts about the war, and read her personal diary, in which she expressed anti-German views. After beating her, burning her, and dislocating her ankle, they locked her in a cell. Without a trial, or even a charge, to speak of, they kept her there on a nearly bread-and-water diet until February of 1941. Not long before her release, a German officer came to her cell. He wondered what would have caused her to act the way she did, why she disliked the occupation and the Germans, when, after all, they'd shown her every courtesy, given the French every chance to be friends. He said she was ridiculous. This attitude, the German officer's attitude, is what passed for sanity in 1940. As the saying goes, sometimes to survive, you have to be a little crazy. Thank you for listening to this, for traveling with me back to the fall of the Third Republic. Despite how long it took to get this episode out, I assure you this is not the end, but, as Churchill once noted, it is perhaps the end of the beginning. I think we've looked at the conditions in 1940 long enough. In future episodes, we'll start looking at other aspects of the resistance. But finally, before we depart, I'd like to look at one other way the resistance might have appeared unusual to those on the outside. Some of this episode was spent looking at the way the Spanish Civil War laid the groundwork for later collaboration between communists and non-communists in the resistance. But while this may have been a birth date for such collaboration, the conception date may be much further back and farther afield. It might harken back to the city of New Orleans in the American state of Louisiana, just after the Civil War. It was a time when, to simplify dealing with recently freed slaves, the legal distinction was no longer one of slave or free, but colored or white. This meant many of French Caribbean descent, people who were not from slave families and considered themselves as much European as anything else, were now forced to follow rules for so-called colors. Rules about where to sit, how to travel, and what bands they can play in. New Orleans was and is a city both musically and ethnically diverse, but diverse can also be divergent. Now the influence of the classical musicians of European extraction mixed with all the other styles that make the New Orleans sound distinct. And in this fusion of sources and backgrounds was forged something so unbidden, so impromptu, that it changed the way we look at rules of art, society, and all that jazz. As Plato observed, musical innovation is full of danger to the state, for when modes of music change, the walls of the city shake. Some such previously unquestioned rules fell under headings like who can and can't work together, and what constitutes an army. To support my heartfelt, if threadbare, thesis, I'm going to quote from Daniel Cordier, writing about the resistance. The translation is mine, so brace yourself. This past, still so alive for me, now seems to me the improvisation of a jazz band whose instruments have been lost and a great part of the recording destroyed. This past traversed with extreme enthusiasm, with devotion without calculation, resembles a concert played only once, and which specialists endeavor to reconstruct with bits of documents or testimonies. At the end of their investigation, perhaps they will discover the composition of the orchestra, or the kind of music played, but whatever their patience, whatever the exactitude of their research, no one could ever again perceive in this music the particular sensitivity of the musicians, nor the richness of its melody, or the complexity of its harmony, such as it was the day it was performed. At most one could try a transcription of the pieces, but the deciphering of each one will never restore the exceptional details of their fusion of rhythms. Only those who assisted with it will preserve in their mind the plenitude of improvisations in this concert, without being able, because of their deformed memories and impotent vocabulary, to share their pleasure, fixed forever in their solitary memory. Thank you again for joining us here at La Resistance, and to the people of the PodSave Music Network for that lovely jazz. In conclusion, we also offer Monsieur Cordier our thanks for encapsulating so perfectly this jazz, this madness, this new creation, this resistance. Until next time, vive la Resistance!